Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Art, like beauty, is very much in the eye of the beholder. Many esteemed artists have their passionate advocates and critics just as passionate. But increasingly, many forms of art are being found all around us. It's called public art. Public art covers a lot of bases. In St. Louis, the arch qualifies. So does the rusting Sarah sculpture. So do those giant Bob Cassily turtles near the zoo. We can be aware without giving it much thought or recognize it for what it is. What does public art tell us about ourselves and our community? Is it important? If so, why? It is important enough that an international conference on the subject opens in St. Louis today. It's the Sculpture City St. Louis 2014 Monument Anti-Monument Conference. Public art and its role on several levels is our subject on today's program. And joining us, conference participants, Mary Lou Knode, Executive Director and Chief Curator at Lohmeyer Sculpture Park. Bradley Bailey is Associate Professor of Art History at St. Louis University, and Sam Durant is a multimedia artist based in Los Angeles. Joining us a little later, Rafael Lozano-Hemmer, an electronic artist and keynote speaker at the conference, which, as I mentioned, starts today. I'm going to start with you, Brad, if I may, and ask you for a definition of public art.
Well, that's very much what this conference is about. But public art has so many different manifestations, whether it's something that has been created by a professional artist that's been commissioned by a municipal branch or something like that, or something that is the product of an individual creating something within their own personal space that can be seen from a variety of different perspectives in the public. So the definition is as broad as the manifestations that it takes on.
So graffiti could be considered public art.
In many ways, yes. Has been considered public art for some time.
Yeah. As well as the arch.
Sure, absolutely.
As well as the arch. Okay, now we have a little clearer understanding of what we're talking about. As well as those turtles, by the way. I've got to get those turtles in.
Of course.
All right. Mary Lou, let me go to you with an explanation of what the monument, anti-monument thing is all about.
It's funny, when we were first talking about this title, it comes from a historical period, 1970s, an artist named Robert Smithson, and a lot of his colleagues thinking about how we can make artwork leave the museum or the gallery space. How can we get out of the conditions of artwork that's seen as not elitist, but exactly, you know, really protected by the envelope of a museum or a gallery space? And so we went out into the real world and started doing a series of earthworks. So we're not against monuments. It just is referencing this movement since the 1970s. But what is at the heart of it for me, in any case, is in St. Louis, our two most important symbols and icons of the city are sculpture. There's the arch, which I think everybody would say is a monument. And then there are the mounds at Cahokia, which I think in some ways we treat as an anti-monument, that it's not a monument to something that's about, you know, human endeavor, human success. I think that the arch and what it symbolizes sort of wipes out the mounds. And so to me, there's this tension that exists in American culture and in St. Louis right at our heart. So there's some big, big questions there.
I think a lot of people might be taken somewhat aback when you speak of the arch as a sculpture, because we think of an artist with a hammer and a chisel and clay or stone or whatever, and that obviously was not the way the arch was constructed.
No, but I have to say, when I first moved to St. Louis, you know, people treat the arch a little bit like they do the Statue of Liberty in New York. People, they know it's there. They don't go to it. They take it for granted. When I first saw the arch up close, I just fell in love with it. It is so exquisite. The angles, the color of the materials, the way that it impacts the landscape, the way you look up at it, it really dwarfs you. It really reminds you about how their sculpture helps us express the aspirations that we have as a community. And this is why it was so important for me that in the year that we're celebrating the 250th anniversary of our modern founding, that let's sort of think about how sculpture has played an important role in us imagining ourselves.
Sam, let me turn to you. The Cahokia was mentioned a moment ago, and this is something I gather that is fairly close to your heart.
Yeah, I mean, there is a kind of, as Mary Lou mentioned, a really strong connection between the symbolic meaning that the arch carries and the sort of on the ground historical record of the mounds of a civilization that was here over 1,000 years ago. And, you know, I think there is a, I don't know, I might say there's a little bit of a difference in the, you know, what the arch has the pretensions of, which is, you know, colonial expansion, westward expansion, which has, of course, positive attributes. But one also wonders what Native Americans think when they look at the arch. It may not be quite as celebratory for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were part of an exhibit at Lomar, were you not, in which Cahokia was involved?
Yeah, and maybe Mary Lou can speak to that. It's an exhibition which I believe is opening this weekend, actually. Uh-huh. Yeah.
But before we go to Mary Lou, though, let me just ask you about this public art, and you're from Los Angeles. Is the Hollywood sign public art?
No. It's, well, it's not, and it's not. This is not just my opinion. It's advertising, and it was put up originally to advertise. It was said Hollywood Land, and it was to advertise a housing subdivision called Hollywood Land.
Uh-huh. So technically, then it doesn't classify.
No, I mean it wasn't intended as art. It wasn't intended as a monument. It was strictly advertising, and you know, I mean, you can argue it's been sort of adopted as a cultural symbol in Los Angeles, but that doesn't make it an artwork. You know, I think advertising and the Marlboro Man is a cultural symbol. It's not an artwork.
Let me turn to Bradley before we come back to Mary Lou. What do you think? Do you agree with what you've just heard?
I think what Sam points out that's interesting to go into is the difference between an artwork and a monument. Because, as Sam points out, an artwork is something that is intentional. It's something that is created in order to be something that challenges or makes us think about something in a different way. A monument can be something that becomes appropriated over time and takes on a meaning outside of what its original impact was supposed to be. The thing that comes to mind immediately for me would be the Rocky statue in Philadelphia, one of the most famous examples of this, which was initially a movie prop that was installed at the top of the steps of the Philadelphia Art Museum, and it was not supposed to remain there. There was a big argument about how what was going to happen to it, whether it was going to be removed, who would pay for that. The Philadelphia Museum of Art did not want it to remain there. After a while, it ended up being put outside the Spectrum Sports Arena, and now it's back near the art museum, not at the top of the steps, which everyone now knows as the Rocky Steps because of the statue and because of the film and the procedure of running up the steps and acting out Rocky, what he did in the film. But it is – that statue is one of the most popular tourist attractions in Philadelphia, and I think there's little question that what it represents holds very close to Rocky's legacy and tradition of the working-class hero. And despite the fact that the Philadelphia Museum of Art rejected it as a work of art, it's become a monument nonetheless, despite that rejection.
Well, can't something start out as something else and become art because of the way it is perceived by the people who admire it or don't admire it? Mary Lou?
Well, I think this is a really at the heart – another part of the thing that we're going to be talking about in the conference starting this afternoon actually is – you know, the definition of public art has become so broad that we have these informal monuments. So, for example, somebody's killed in a car accident. People come and lay wreaths or put a little cross up. Those become informal monuments. The people at Columbine High School have been saving all the materials that people put in mourning for the students that were killed there, the students and teachers that were killed. So we've really broadened our definition of what public art is so that it's informal, it's not coming top down, it's coming from bottom up. It's about the general public expressing something specific about their own lives and them appropriating what we call monumentation.
I don't want to go too far afield, but it occurs to me, the way this conversation has evolved, that propaganda can be considered art in certain circumstances. Agreed?
Absolutely.
Explain.
What comes to mind in regard to that would be the in Eastern Europe, there's a number of cities that were filled with propagandist art from Soviet era. And a lot of these sort of makeshift sculpture parks have gone from being repositories of unwanted and no longer relevant propagandistic messages now to becoming sculpture parks in their own right. Moscow's got a very famous one outside of the State Tretyakov Gallery, which I was lucky to see recently. Mm-hmm. I had known about it from grainy black and white pictures that I'd seen in graduate school, but to actually be there, these sculptures still have a tremendous power and aura to them because these were figures who I had grown up fearing. I had associated them with, you know, danger to myself and to my family. And these were created by professional artists whose names might not be known today, but they still – their meaning has maybe changed and it's evolved, but they still carry a tremendous power and gravity.
Sam, that power is really a testament to whatever the propaganda is about as opposed to the artist, right?
Yeah. I mean, I would say you could make an argument that all art is propaganda – in the sense that all art, represents and serves certain interests. It's just that we call the art that has a more explicit social or political subject matter propagandistic or political or something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the arch. If you were standing in Russia today, you might look at the arch in St. Louis as a propagandistic monument. I won't call it an artwork, I mean, I think that's an interesting argument as well. Yeah. What's a monument? Is a monument an artwork? Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. I mean, this is what Mary Lou's getting us to talk about at the conference.
Bradley?
And what Sam points out about the arch is very interesting because in the late 40s, after the design of the arch had been released, it was very controversial. There was public outcry more about just that it didn't seem to represent anything. People called it the stupendous hairpin and a croquet wicket and these, you know, more kind of, you know, satirical type things. But a more serious accusation was leveled at it because in 1942 there was a design by an Italian architect, Adalberto Libera, and the design was almost identical to the arch, and it was a fascist Mussolini-approved symbol for the 1942 Rome Exposition. And Ira Saarinen, the designer of the arch, kind of shrugged off this accusation and said, how can a single political message be attached to a universal symbol that's been around for thousands of years? It symbolizes what you choose it to symbolize. And this is part of the complexity of abstraction in public art as well and in memorials, because abstraction, what you end up with is a subjective opinion of the viewer. It's very difficult to advance a specific message through abstraction, which is why fascist regimes throughout history have tended to avoid abstraction and choose realism, because it's easier to advance a message.
As I recall from a recent book, Saarinen was actually accused of a form of plagiarism for taking that design.
Yes, he was. Yes, yeah. Yes. And he shrugged that accusation off too, again, because of the universality of the arch as a symbol.
Sure, of course. We have to take a break. Let's do that now. We're talking about public art, and you'll learn more about it, what it is, and why it's important in just a moment. My guests in studio are Mary Lou Knode, Executive Director and Chief Curator at Lohmeyer Sculpture Park. Bradley Bailey is an Associate Professor of Art History at St. Louis University. Sam Durant also with us. He joins us in studio, although he is from Los Angeles. He's a multimedia artist. All are taking part in the conference that is getting underway here in St. Louis today on this issue. It is an international conference, by the way. We'll come back to continue the conversation. If you'd like to get into it, feel free to do so. We'd like to hear about what you feel is your favorite item of public art, if you will. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation on public art. With me in studio, Mary Lou Knode, Executive Director and Chief Curator at Lohmeyer Sculpture Park. I've been mispronouncing that. I apologize. Bradley Bailey is Associate Professor of Art History at St. Louis University. Sam Durant also with us. He joins us in studio, although he is from Los Angeles. He is a multimedia artist. Mary Lou, back to you. Why is public art important?
Well, public art is where the public is. And I think there's an interesting crisis in museums right now. Museums play an extremely important role in preserving material culture that helps us understand our past and our future. But public art takes it on the road. They go outside where people's defenses aren't up. It actually can help shape place, your understanding of place. I think the arch is certainly one of those objects that does that. And it comes in so many different forms. I think that public art has the capacity to speak to the diversity and the complexity of human life. And so it's both this sort of celebratory great invention of the human mind, but also it just sort of lightens the rather banality of most urban spaces.
But in terms of St. Louis, it's all over the place. Again, I refer going from the arch to the turtles or to even paintings on the sides of some historic buildings. Mm-hmm. Bradley, what does that tell us about us in St. Louis?
Well, it for one thing, it speaks to the history, and it speaks to the diversity of the population, and not just in a sort of socioeconomic sense, but what aspects of the community have we chosen to memorialize, and why are these the aspects that we choose? When you look downtown, there's so many memorials between. Across the gateway, basically from Union Station down to the Arch. When I talk to people, sometimes I'll use them as directions because I know them so well. Mm-hmm. I'll say, you make a left at the World War II Memorial, and people will say, I don't know where that is. I think the problem is that there's almost so many, and they reflect so many different aspects of the community that it can be overwhelming because other than the Arch, there isn't one that kind of represents a sort of central aspect of the community. And this is again, part of what I think the conference is about is in what different ways does a community reject public art or monuments? In what different ways it can be anything from something vandalism to just neglect, to forgetting about it, not maintaining it, and over time it loses whatever power or aura it had. And becomes something that is an eyesore and oftentimes needs to be removed to protect the aesthetic nature of the city.
I would think that there's another iconic example, though, and that would be the statue of King Louis in front of the Art Museum.
Absolutely. That's a pretty fundamental image for the city itself. And I think the fact that there are so many different ideas at the heart of the public art in the city, again, it's a reflection of the diversity of the ideas that have existed in the city of St. Louis. So one of the things that I've been thinking about is how our landscape demonstrates this idea of succession cultures in St. Louis. So we have the mounds, which were so important 1,000 years ago, and that has national resonance, too. It's not just about St. Louis, but that almost every decade, almost every era, almost every immigrant group here has its own memorials, has ways of expressing something about the world that they have brought with them to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Sam Durant, have you been here long enough to get any sense of our public art here? And if so, what are your impressions?
I have a very limited view. I've been to St. Louis just a couple of times and, seen things here and there. Obviously, the Arch and the Cahokia Mounds, I wouldn't call them public art, but they're certainly monumental. The Richard Serra sculpture I'm familiar with. It was fairly controversial. It has been over the years. The World's Exposition here and the I'm forgetting the name of the park now. Forest Park, yeah. Those kinds of things, exactly, show this really long history of the city and the area and, as Mary Lou said, of the succession of cultures, yeah.
What might we know about public art in your town, Los Angeles? I mentioned the Hollywood sign. I wasn't trying to be facetious at all because it is the iconic symbol of that city. But I can't think of anything else right offhand. What would you suggest?
Well, I think we were speaking earlier about a situation that we have had in Los Angeles for a number of years. And, in one way, Los Angeles is one of the capitals of murals, Chicano murals in particular. which tell the story of the actually indigenous population. California was originally part of Mexico. So many of the people that we call Chicano actually are indigenous. The city council attempted to put constraints on advertising. And in order to do that, they had to limit all public speech. So we have a ban on murals, which we're just now, this has been going on for years. So just now being able to start to approve murals. And I think, you know, because of that ban, the city hasn't been able to capitalize on that incredible tradition and telling a story of the city and of its people.
That brings it to something that I would call the politics of public space. Is that an issue here, Mary Lou?
Well, I think this is where you get into some really technical questions about public art. So in the 1970s, the public art movement started where municipalities would set aside maybe 1% of a building program and have public art at a site. But often in those early years, it would be a piece of artwork that was brought in and put down on a plaza. And they call that plop art, which is not a very flattering term.
P-L-O-P.
Yeah. So, and because it means that this work could go anywhere. It could be plopped down in your front yard. It could be plopped down in my backyard. And that's not a flattering term at all. It's actually probably the worst thing you can say. And I would say that, you know, in some ways, public art from that era might be more like beautification than something that's central to what the built environment can represent for the population of a town. Things have changed a lot. Public art administrators across the country have realized that's not the best way to really utilize the incredible wide range of skills that artists have to express something more fundamental. The 1% law can be also a little scandalous for architects because they want often that last 1% to make art. But if you can't make art 99% of the budget, that's a bit of a problem.
Well, let's stop right there because I wanted to bring up the 1%. I'm not sure that our audience understands what you're talking about. Why don't you explain what the 1% rule, if that's the right expression, is?
Well, when it's often municipalities, when they have a building program, they set aside 1% of their budget for an artist to make artwork. So it might be that includes all the fees for an artist, their salary effectively, production, shipping, hiring engineers to make sure that the artwork's not going to fall off and hurt anybody, to make sure that the piece is appropriately integrated into the building site itself.
These are only public buildings, or are they buildings over a certain cost?
There may be a threshold for budgets. There are some parts of the country where they've imposed that on any construction within a city. So, for example, Scottsdale, Arizona, any building happening within Scottsdale has to have 1% set aside.
Including private homes?
No, not homes, but it would be like big developments over a threshold. So, and that field has changed quite a bit, that sometimes you get small projects with small budgets, and what do you get for a very little bit of money? You don't get great art, let's face it. So some municipalities are saying, well, what we're going to do is we're going to bank the 1% over a two-year period, so we've got a much bigger pool, and we get much better artwork that really symbolizes something much more significant.
How about here in St. Louis? Do we have the 1% rule?
We do have 1%. We have an explosion of public sculpture parks in a lot of the municipalities. I would say that a lot of people understand that public art really helps make place. And so there's an increasing interest in public art.
Give me an example of something that we might know that as a result of the 1%.
Well, Grand Center has done a temporary public art program. Last year it was a string by a group called Thought Barn that was in Grand Center over by the Symphony.
Right. Bradley, a good idea?
Well, where we run into problems is that this money, money that comes out of taxes or some other kind of public fund, the problem that will often happen is this: the artwork that's chosen is put together frequently by a committee of some kind that's made up of experts in the art field and, you know, other individuals who are considered part of that art community. And the public may be paying for funding this in part or entirely, yet have virtually no say ultimately in what the ultimate manifestation of that is. So on the one hand, they're paying for it, but they have no way of being involved in the selection process. And then even more than that, there's no organized forum in which the public can speak out when in the case that a faction or you know, part of the community might reject this. There's no organized way in which to voice one's opinion about it. And so what ends up happening is are things like vandalism and other, you know, sort of more, you know, kind of renegade actions, because the community lacks the kind of infrastructure to provide the community with a way of voicing their opinion about this. The artwork oftentimes is in a way, I think they perceive it as being forced upon them.
That would bring us – oh, go ahead, Marilyn.
Well, I was just going to say that I've been on, I think, three or four public art programs in the city of St. Louis. People take the public process very, very seriously. So, for example, up at the airport, they've got this, you know, really great committee, but they also have some people who are not experts on it as well. And the debate always really is, well, what does this place mean to the public? What's its history? How do we want to express something? Again, we assume that public art is expressing something that's enlivening, that has some sort of not spiritual base to it exactly, but that it's the positive part of culture. And so often I think that the conversations become very dynamic where it's, you know, I know as a professional, it's really about, I mean, what would be really interesting for the public? What doesn't exist here? And yet I would say that relative, like we're maybe 10 people in a room as opposed to a million people. You're right. That's the big gap between, you know, what's really public about public art.
Bradley, back to you. Is the Sarah sculpture Twain, is that an example of plop art?
No, that's an example of site-specific art designed particularly for that location.
Okay. I bring that up because when you talk about debate and controversy and enlivening the discussion, that certainly fits the bill. I mean, people didn't have a whole lot to say about that, but people either hated it or loved it.
And it's not unusual that a public artwork will cause such a polarity in terms of opinion. They can be very divisive. In terms of St. Louis, I mean, you can point to virtually any sculpture in downtown or in the city somewhere where there's some group or some section of the community that doesn't feel that it represents them. There's not going to ever be an artwork that can represent the values and what it is a community believes it's all about. That's one of the bad things about it. That's also one of the great things about what a community is that, you know, this is a group of people and they have a right and they have, you know, the ability to say this is not something that I like. This might not have been the case in, you know, Soviet Russia or, you know, what we were talking about before about propagandist art, where what people felt about it was irrelevant because it was meant to carry a very, very specific message about what your role in society is. Whereas here, if something doesn't represent you and what you believe the values of your community are, you can express that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the sculpture will be altered or that it will be taken down. It just means that you have the right to your subjective response to it.
Sam Durant, from the artist's perspective, what's your thought about this? Not about Sarah necessarily, but about controversy and people reacting negatively or reacting really at all to something you've done.
Well, I think it really depends on the situation. It depends on what the artwork is and what it's addressed to. You know, and I really think nowadays there's an increased interest in specificity. What are the general abstract ideas at play, but what about the specificities of the work itself, the community it's located in, and all these things? So I think that's a really good thing. I mean, one way that artists increasingly are dealing with the question of public art, in other words, how do you do an artwork that's for a public, a community, whatever you want? And one of the approaches I think is really interesting is has been termed dialogical. So the artist basically works with those in the constituency, community, area who are interested and together come up with a project. It's not that the artist comes in with a preconceived idea. They don't. They listen to the community. The community is involved in producing something. It may not even be an object. And I think, you know, this is something that's going on all over the world now. It's a kind of new way for artists to work collaboratively. And then you don't have so much controversy, you know, around. It's less of a kind of, you know, the Twain sculpture pushes a lot of buttons, unconscious buttons in people. I would argue that it has a very strong propagandistic message, but it's a different one from figurative art.
What are some of the things you've done? And you're a multimedia guy. What are some of the kinds of things you've done in the realm of public art?
Well, excuse me. Last year I did a project at the Getty Center in Los Angeles, and I worked with the education department. And I took this dialogical approach. They asked me to do an artwork at the museum that would engage with the visitors. And so I work with the education department. Well, what would you like to do? What are the constituencies that you don't feel you serve well? And together we came up with a project that was called What is a Museum? And a lot of it took place online as well. So there were all these questions posed to visitors at the Getty, also on their website. And then people could respond to these questions. And they were aggregated, and they developed the technology to aggregate all these answers so that they would then be sort of a feedback loop, making a discussion. So we use Twitter, Facebook, et cetera. And that's, you know, the digital sphere, the internet is another public that artists can use. And I was very interested in using that as well.
Technology is changing art.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's changing art, but it's a new kind of public. So rather than about being about place, or it is a place, it's the internet. It's a different place.
Yeah. In which you can find anything, including all art, just about.
Apparently, yeah.
Apparently, yeah. I have to take another break. We'll do that and come back. We'll bring in another guest. And I also want to get back to the Cahokia thing at Lomar. And we'll do that when we come back. Once again, we're talking about public art. My guests in studio are Mary Lou Knode, Bradley Bailey, and Sam Durant. We'll be joined in a little bit with Rafael Lozano-Hammer, who is a keynote speaker at the conference that gets underway here in St. Louis a little later in the day. And once again, if you'd like to get into the discussion, feel free to do so. Your favorite public art? We'd love to know what it is here in St. Louis. 382-8255 is the number. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our discussion on public art. We'll be joined by a fourth guest in just a moment, but I want to come back to Mary Lou Knode, with regard to where we got started in this discussion. We'd started talking about the Cahokia Mounds, and at Laumar you have something that's going to be starting relating to that in the next couple of days. Tell us about that.
Well, we're opening our show Mound City tomorrow night at 6 o'clock, and we're having a performance at 7:30 by a group called a tribe named Red. They're from Ottawa. And the show Mound City is part of a series we've been organizing under the rubric Archaeology of Place, because Laumar is so rooted in place. We're a landscape that is shaped by the people who have lived in St. Louis, and we've been always in our 38-year history really reflecting on place. And so we've got a long history of commissioning site-specific artworks. You might only see 60 things when you go to Laumar, but we've commissioned hundreds of things that are reflecting on the conditions of Laumar in St. Louis. So Mound City is really about what are the traces of Native culture and contemporary society. And Sam's made a piece, and it's not just Native society, it's about this idea of succession cultures. So Sam's done a piece based on a reflection on the arch and the mounds and what that disjunct in the American psyche represents. We've got an artist named Marie Watt, who's part Native American, and she's also reflecting on how we shape the landscape. And an artist named Jeffrey Kraswick, who's doing a new ruin in the woods at Laumar. So it's really some very interesting things that we're doing.
Sam, can you tell us about your contribution? Again, is it a multimedia presentation?
No, not really. I mean, it's a fairly conventional in terms of materials. The only materials really is steel. It's called Free Hanging Chain, And it's based on the catenary arch. So you to make that arch form, you hold two ends of a chain and let it hang. And, I mean, you have to have the right distance apart, but you that will form what's called a catenary arch. And so I simply installed free-hanging chains in the forest or on the, along a trail at Laumeier. So they're up in the trees. And I really just being very literal about what free hanging chain might mean in American history, those three words and so forth. Yeah,
that sounds fascinating. And this is obviously not a permanent exhibit, or is it, Mary Lou?
Well, all of these installations could stay with us for a long time. Of course, that always depends on how much money we have. But the show is up through August 25th, so we'll have it for a while. But we've also... this is the second time we've done this. We're a program called Loans That Don't Move. You know, it's we don't have a space right now because our building's under renovation. We're building a new museum space. And so in order for us to really explore the very complex ideas in our shows, we're borrowing, quote-unquote, artworks that exist in other in many of the other very fantastic institutions in the city. So we'll have some materials over at Cahokia Mounds that'll be part of the story of the exhibition. We're borrowing a chunk key from the St. Louis Art Museum. We're really pointing out the fact that scattered across the landscape of St. Louis, there are all these different kinds of institutions that are incredibly rich, institutions that don't exist in other cities in the same way. And so it's part of us just really celebrating what exists here.
We're going to bring in our other guest right now. He's been waiting patiently in Montreal, and that would be Rafael Lozano Hemmer, electronic artist and keynote speaker at the Monument Anti-Monument Conference, which gets underway here later today. Rafael, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Let me ask you to explain for me and for, I'm sure, for many members of our audience, what an electronic artist is.
Well, it's an artist who works with the inevitability of technology. In other words, I work with new media, though I dislike the term new because I think that this is a long tradition of artists who have been working with experimentation with all sorts of different electronic means. But basically, it's an artist who understands that our culture, our economy, our politics, our war, they're all mediated through this new electronic reality, and so inevitably ends up working with the same media.
Can you give me an example, something that you can describe that would illustrate what you're doing for us?
Sure. I make kind of large-scale interactive installations that are often, I call them platforms for self-representation. What that means is that instead of having like a son et lumière, like a sound and light show that tries to represent the richness of a particular culture or something like this, or some kind of cathartic fireworks display or something like this, instead the projects are platforms for people to self-represent. So oftentimes what you get are, for example, shadow plays or light sculptures or sound environments, all of which have a content that is not imposed so much by me, but rather derived from the participation of the general public. So the idea is, yes, create these large-scale interventions in public space, but make sure that they have the intimacy and the relationship to the general public as a participant.
This is what we would call interactive art?
Sure, yeah. Although, you know, the word interactive means so many things to so many people. I mean, Marcel Duchamp said that, you know, it's the look that makes the painting. So if you take that position, then all art is interactive.
Bradley, what do you make of this?
There has in recent years been an increase in trying to find ways to bring the audience into the artwork. One of the speakers or one of the panelists of my session coming up is one of the members of the commissioning group for a project called the Fourth Plinth, which is in Trafalgar Square in London. There's a number of large plinths that have colossal sculpture on them, and one of them was bare for a long time. And it was finally in the late 90s that it was decided to turn this into a contemporary art space. And one of the more popular projects that was done was one by an artist named Anthony Gormley, who did a project where Mary Lou maybe even knows the procedure better than I do, but you were basically allowed to sign up for a period of time on the plinth where you could do anything you wanted up there as long as – and if you could use whatever props you wanted as long as you could carry them up there yourself. And you would have an amount of time where you would be able to express virtually anything about yourself and your community that you wanted to. And this is kind of revelatory in terms of thinking about a way that a public artwork could truly represent the entire community. But of course, there's a limited amount of time. There's a limited number of people that can get up there. So while it might have the veneer of being truly democratic and truly expressing the entire view of the community, it still in some ways is limited.
Raphael, you have an international reputation. And I'm just wondering how we, in terms of embracing public art, we in this country stack up against other parts of the world.
Well, I have benefited very much from traditions of light and sound shows that they're had for, you know, hundreds of years in Europe. A lot of my work has taken place in Europe. And when I try to do the similar thing here in North America, I live in Canada, and the relationship is a little bit similar to the States. I haven't found ways to actually do that without too much corporate encroachment, because the kind of show that I make is very expensive, is short-lived, it's ephemeral, it lasts only for, say, a month or a couple months. What I think is basically the situation is that public space in North America is becoming more and more a private space, and there is certainly a need, I think, to create spaces for, you know, collective representation, for people to feel a sense of agency, of being a stakeholders in their own cities. The distribution, for instance, of public plazas is something that needs to be sort of understood. The ways that shopping malls actually affect these public spaces where, you know, we're supposed to self-represent is a consideration or a concern. So I would say that the situation in North America is very different from that in the in Europe, for instance, or in Latin America for that matter.
Bradley, this idea of corporate encroachment gives a whole new slant to this.
Well,
yeah. Sorry.
Go ahead, Raphael. If you'd like to answer, go ahead.
Right. I was just. I think the challenge for the artist is to be able to create a work that is not an advertisement for whoever is sponsoring the project, while at the same time understanding that a lot of the time corporate involvement is solicited and it is important. But one of the things that I refuse, for instance, is what some colleagues of mine called logo creep, which is this idea that if you get this funding from a company, that you don't convert the public space into some kind of Grand Prix with lots of logos all around, but rather that you take more a museum approach where there is a corporate acknowledgement to the donation, for instance, but it's understood more as a gift. Because if all of a sudden in one of these public interventions you have an ad or a logo, people get betrayed. You betray the trust that you have with the general public, and that backfires on the company, on the artists, and on the city itself.
There's nothing like a good old Nike swish to inspire you, right?
Right. And so, you know, I have turned down many shows where the sponsors have not understood this need to create a space that is as independent as possible, that's understood as a gift. And you know, museums, you know, worry about this all the time, and they have found ways to do this relationships that are more subtle, more elegant. You know, you have programs, you have all sorts of different ways that companies can get involved in this without being crass.
I have a number of people on the line who want to get into this conversation. There are so many different ways that we could go, would like to go, but time won't allow it. Let's get some of our listeners, though, into the discussion. We'll start with Laura, calling from St. Louis. Laura, go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. This has been a fascinating discussion today. I'm calling to ask the group about the role of public art in defining a neighborhood, kind of a residential community as opposed to a public space like an entertainment district. And specifically also related to that, what's the role of music in the role in defining public spaces as an art form? I live in Old North St. Louis, and there's been a steel drum player who's been setting up his stand outside Crayon Candy this year, and it's really changed the character of the neighborhood. It may not be the music form that we would have selected as residents if we had thought about it, what music we would define us, but it really does change how you experience this neighborhood in ways I had not previously thought of. And so welcome some comments from the group on that.
All right, Laura, thanks so much for the call. Who would like to take that? Mary Lou?
Well, I would just say that at Laumeier, we think very broadly about what public art is. And in fact, we will take anything as public art. So, for example, we commissioned through our in-residence composer, actually a couple of years ago, he commissioned a series of musicians to do oral portraits of our collection, and those pieces of music are now in our collection. And so we really think that anything that affects your impression of three-dimensional space could be considered, you know, public art. And I think the point about how do you find something specific for a neighborhood, I think it depends on how cohesive that neighborhood is. And this is really one of the great things about public art is people are not cohesive. And so to imagine, to put the burden upon an artist or an artwork to express, you know, everything that everybody wants is why you get a lot of very neutral, abstract artworks, because it's about not offending anyone. Hmm. If you get too specific, you're gonna offend everybody.
Sure. Anybody else want to weigh in on this, or shall we move along?
I'd like to say that I find that it's a real problem when artists pretend to represent a community or a group of people. Edward Said would call that identitarian. It is absolutely impossible to have an exhaustive representation. And the caller's example of the steel drum player is great because it shows how, in fact, what the community needed was not something that would represent them, but something that would transform them. So I think that oftentimes the public art that I'm most attractive by is art that is intensely eccentric to the area where it is done. It redefines the space. It creates a new sort of relationship for that community to forge forward, as opposed to try and do something that in a way is a reflection of the public around them.
We only have a minute and a half left. I want to get Donna in from Crestwood because I think she has a question or comment that will relate directly to Mary Lou. It'll have to be quick, Donna. Go ahead.
Okay. I was just wondering, there's a little spring on the grounds of Laumeier that is really nice, and it's got a little shelter made of stone that I guess is like a folk art thing. It's been there for ages, I guess. And it's just being allowed to deteriorate, and the rocks fall down, the spring is all full of mud. It just seems like that would be really nice to enhance that somehow, to combine the nature and the art aspects that are so prevalent at Laumeier.
Well, that's actually a spring house. That's actually a little shelter that was built in the early 20th century by the people who you know, founded our building. The stream moved, actually, and I think that was caused partially by the construction on the hill above us, that the pads that were put in diverted the stream. And so now that we have Prop P for St. Louis County Parks, I suspect we're going to be seeing some very good work on the infrastructure in the park. But thank you for saying it. I'll pass that along to the head of parks.
Our time is up. You do have a website for your organization, do you not? Give it to us very quickly, mm-hmm. And we'll put it online.
www.laumeier.org.
All right. And for Sculpture City?
SculptureCity.com.
All right. Very, very easy. Wish we had more time, folks. It is up. Unfortunately, you just heard from Mary Lou Knode, Executive Director and Chief Curator at Laumeier Sculpture Park. Bradley Bailey is with us from St. Louis University, Associate Professor of Art History. Also with us in studio, Sam Durant, multimedia artist. He is based in Los Angeles, but is joining us here for the conference that is taking place starting today. And Rafael Lozano Hammer, electronic artist and keynote speaker at that conference, has joined us by phone from Montreal. Thank you all so much for being with us. It's been a very interesting discussion.
Thank you.
Have a great conference.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll talk with cast members from the production of the musical Once at the Fox and with installation artist Wanju Kim about her new exhibit at the St. Louis Art Museum. He'll also talk with two of the people featured in the St. Louis Poetry Center's National Poetry Month celebration of Dylan Thomas. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about how to make neighborhoods what their residents want them to be. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Amanda Huntingfort, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.